at the Sermon on the Mount, and we're talking about what the teachings are that he gave to us to be able to understand more about his will for our life, who we are, what it is that we are to accomplish, and what it is that he wants us to be able to do for him. As we read Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 26. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law of the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. And therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the heaven and the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Raca,' is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar first. Go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court, and do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." May God bless the reading of his word. Some of you will remember from 1954 to 1963, Jim Anderson, the manager of the General Insurance Company, guided his family through all kinds of dilemmas. For 203 episodes of the sitcom Father Knows Best, period. Father Knows Best, period. So dads, I'm there with you. Right? Robert Young gained further fame as Marcus Welby, M.D., this is the son, while his television daughter grew up to become Miss Ellie, which was Andy Taylor's love on the Andy Griffith Show. But the title notwithstanding, father did not always know best. Sometimes on the show, the father was outright wrong. And while his wife, who was played by Jane Wyatt, was often on the winning end of that conflict, does that sound familiar, guys? The two daughters were also known to argue victoriously against the quandary of the day. Now, the show actually debuted as a radio sitcom in 1949. And in the audio version, the title ended in a question mark. It was "Father Knows Best?" question mark. See the difference? The question mark, of course, was removed when the show was moved to television in 1954. And perhaps they would have been better to stick to the original title, "Father Knows Best?" question mark, because we human fathers know that the statement should end in a question mark, because our history of mistakes is evidence that we clearly don't always know best. We come to the section of the Sermon on the Mount here as Jesus, the Son of God, reveals one of the greatest truths about his relationship with the Father. He can read the Father's mind. Jesus offers us a glimpse into the thought process of the Father, and thus the Father always knows best. As we gather around the feet this morning, as they did then, of our Lord on the mountainside, we need to remember that he has already spelled out for us the source of blessing in the Beatitudes. He is also, just last week we talked about how he has commissioned us to be the salt and the light in the world of tastelessness and darkness. In this section, Jesus takes us to a new level of understanding when he leads us inside the mind of the Father. Father knows best, and this is what he says. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, the first verse of the New Testament, it reads, "A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Now, you don't have Bibles in your pews there, but if you have a Bible with you, I want you to take your Bible, and I want you to go from Genesis 1 all the way through Malachi chapter 4, verse 6. That's the entire Old Testament. And hold it in your hand. Because Jesus knew that when he said what he said on the Sermon on the Mount, that most of the human beings that were there would think that he was taking this entire portion of the Bible and saying it doesn't apply anymore to your life. The Old Testament. Jesus said, when we read what he just said in that section of Matthew, we would think that none of these words had any application in our life anymore. And so even as we do with the genealogy of Matthew, of Jesus, we speculate that we can ignore everything in the past in our haste to get to Jesus. We're in a rush to get to forgiveness, to get to grace, to get to his return, to get to the reconciliation with the Father. But Jesus says that we should not think, in his words, that he intends for us to ignore these pages. Matter of fact, he says this, in verse 17, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Jesus came to tell us what the Father meant. Remember, Father knows best. The people of the Old Testament, particularly the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, we've heard a lot of stories about them, and as we go into the Old Testament, we'll see them. They were very strict adherents to the law. They knew the law backwards and forwards, and nothing could interfere with their obedience. They were the ancestral authors of the bumper sticker. You guys have seen it, right? These bumper stickers that you put on your car, you know, Jesus would do this, or what would Jesus do, or any of those types of things. Well, the Pharisees' bumper sticker said, "God said it, I believe it, that settles it." That's what their bumper sticker said. And so whether they put them on the back of their chariots or not, the Pharisees were the original, "God said it, I believe it, that settles it" people. All they had to do, in their mind, was live by the minimum standard that was set forth in the Old Testament law. It was a faith of bare necessity, just to do the basic minimum. And as long as they did the thou shalt and didn't do the thou shalt nots, they thought they were fine. They lost the meaning of why God had given them the rules. You see, when our focus is on performing the letter of the law, we ignore the reason behind the law. We lose sight of the Father's desire that we develop a relationship with the one who created the law. Many of you have heard these stories that I found that I think illustrate this point perfectly. The first story, a young woman had a strange habit of cutting off the ends of a ham just before she baked it. When her child asked her why she cut the ends off before she baked the ham, she responded that her mother had always done it that way, and that's how she was taught to bake a ham. Having never really thought why, but now curious after having been asked the question by her daughter, she went to her mother and asked, "Why do you cut the ends of the ham off?" And she replied that her mother, the child's grandmother, or great-grandmother, had always cut off the ends of the ham. And so she had just done that because that's how you prepared the ham. But then she also felt interested, and so the child went to the great-grandmother and asked her, "Why is it that you cut the ends of the ham off as you prepare it. And she said that our oven, as we got, when we were growing up, our oven was too small to put the entire ham to hold the large roasting pan, and so I had to cut the ends off to get the pan in so it would fit into the oven. But because she did that, her daughter did it, and her daughter did it after her. And now the granddaughter, the great-granddaughter, was looking at it and trying to determine how we do this as we teach. Similarly, a devout man enjoyed his time alone with God every morning by spending an hour kneeling by his bed reading the Bible and praying. But during this time, his cat decided that that was the time that they needed the man's attention too, and so they would jump up onto the bed, lay across the Bible, and get in the way so he couldn't read the scriptures. And so in order to fix that problem, the man tied the cat to the bedpost for the hour so that he could keep the cat out of the way. The man's daughter witnessed this routine from the hallway, and so as she developed her time with God, she would have a brief daily devotion each morning in the bedroom before getting ready for the day. And to emulate her dad, to be like her dad, she would tie her cat to the bedpost during the day, during that time, vaguely remembering that her father had always prayed at the bed and had tied that cat to the end of the bed. And her son then saw her doing this and inquired, "Why do you do this?" And of course, she just said, "Because it's what Dad did, right? It's what Mom did." And so, wanting to be like his mother, who wanted to be like her father, he developed a similar morning tradition. So every morning when he got up, he'd find the cat, who didn't have any interest anymore, I don't think, in getting up and laying on the bed. But they would still get the cat, tie the cat to the bed so that they could pray. And then he would go to the kitchen and drink his coffee and read the morning paper. And only after he had showered and dressed for work would he untie the poor cat. Jesus, in these words that he is giving us, knows that we would insist on cutting off the ends of the ham. He knows that we would insist on tying the cat to the bedpost long after we forget why we did those things or how it came to be. We would just do it. And if we're not careful, we might possibly even come to worship just because it's Sunday. Or maybe we would bow our heads for prayer and not even communicate with God. Just bow our heads because that's what we're supposed to do. Imagine we might also even stand for a hymn and not listen to the words and think about what they are communicating with God. Jesus said he did not come to prevent our cooking the ham in the oven, or to forbid a morning prayer at our bedside. He came to tell us why the Father wants us to do what he said to do. "I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill them," he said. Then he goes on in the next 10 minutes of his sermon, and he reached into the law books of the past, and he singles out 6 laws that we obey, but that we misunderstand. The seriousness of what he is saying is emphasized by his conditional statement of introduction. This is what he says. Listen carefully to these words. "If you don't understand the meaning behind the law, if you only live to get by the law, then you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." These are serious words. What does he mean? He means if you just came to the altar because you're supposed to come to the altar and bow and say a prayer and think that you're going to be saved, you're not. He means if you think that you come and you get baptized just because that's what you're supposed to do, that you really haven't done anything to signify your belief in Jesus Christ. And so he starts out with the issue of the law of human life. He says the rule against taking human life. He says every one of the Jews, and us for that matter, knows these words are sacred ground. From the top of another mountain, God spoke these words to Moses, and they are recorded as commandment number 6. you shall not murder. And so from this mountain that he's on now, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Think about this. Jesus did not come to tell us that murder was permissible. Human life is far too valuable for someone else to take it. But Jesus did come to tell us that while the Father instructed us not to murder, the deeper meaning of his command was that we should not even be angry. That is the completion of the law. That is the fulfillment of what God told Moses ages ago. Jesus exposes us to the intention of God. Father knows best. God opposes murder, but he is also against the inner attitude that leads us to kill people with our minds. The concept was almost too difficult for the people who were gathered around Jesus to accept. It's almost too difficult for us to accept. If you have a King James Version of the Bible that you're looking at, you will notice that there is a phrase there that I did not read. The King James says, whoever is angry with his brother without cause. Some later versions of Matthew's gospel add the phrase, without cause. However, the earliest known manuscripts, the original ones that were found in the caves, don't have without cause in them. So, over the years, the scribes have added without cause to give some sense of reason to this demanding statement. And the reality is that anger is not even justifiable cause. Do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. No exceptions. When you or I are angry with another person, we kill him or her by a very slow death, don't we? At least in our minds. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's someone that I read, have read his writings, he's dead now, but he writes that, quote, anger is always an attack on the brother's life, for it refuses to let him live and aims at his destruction, unquote. Our anger at another human being devalues that person and places him less valuable than us, a concept that goes against the nature of God. In short, we kill human life when we are angry. Knowing that this thought would be so revolutionary that they might not even be able to comprehend it, Jesus elaborates with three illustrations. Each of the illustrations offers a deeper insight into this anger problem. The first is that a small word spoken in anger kills the spirit. Now, the Jews already had a rule that said you can't say raka to someone. Raka was a huge insult to a person's character. And Jewish law provided that a person would be subject to the judgment of the Sanhedrin. That's the same as being called before the deacon board for you Baptists. Okay? A little worse, actually, because the Sanhedrin could actually send you to prison for the rest of your life. I don't think our deacons do that yet. Or maybe the pastor comes to your house to visit you afterwards. I don't know. However you want to look at it, it was a bad thing. Okay? Jewish law said that the Sanhedrin, if you were accused of calling someone raka, that they would then pass judgment upon you. But Jesus says that our responsibility doesn't stop there. Jesus says it's not just saying raka or that someone, you know, is awful. It's also being angry at them. You cannot base your behavior on the limits of what is legal and what is not, he says. When the law might disallow raka and permit someone to say fool, it's not the same thing. We have to rise to a higher level, Jesus says, and refrain from such language about anyone ever. These words are tantamount to murder as they diminish the value of human life. Now, that may sound like a bunch of semantics, and again, you all know that I'm trained as a lawyer, so I look at the meaning of words. I try to figure out what can we get, you know, how far can we push the line and not cross it, right? That's my job. That's what I did for people when I was practicing law for 10 years. Try to keep everybody within the boundaries of the law, but also allow them as much freedom and opportunity as they wanted. But Jesus says, don't even do that when it comes to being angry. Don't say rocket, don't say fool. He wants us to hear that the law permits some things and forbids others, and we have to obey the law and do even more than what the law requires. This is not a passage about political correctness or Aramaic slang. It's a word about the value that we place on people. That's what Jesus is talking about. When we treat another individual with anger and speak even the smallest of degrading words about him or her, we are guilty of what God had in mind when he told Moses to tell us that we should not commit murder. A second example is your offering. And again, we participated in that procedure this morning. And he says that we probably never thought about how murder is related to worship. The scenario that we come into worship, we sing our hymns, we pray our prayers, we go through the whole thing, and then we read our litanies or we listen to the sermon that the pastor preaches, and then the offering plate is passed, and in it we place our gifts to honor God. That's the only reason why you should be giving anything in this church building or online or at any time. You should only be giving it to honor God. He doesn't want us to honor him if we're not going to honor each other. If we're not going to honor our brother and sister, he doesn't want our honor. Because it's not true. It's not real. We come into his house and we express love toward him if we have done something to create anger with one of his children. Jesus says that we have to leave and seek reconciliation if we have offended one of our family. The only way to worship God is to be reconciled with each other, with God's children. I wonder if we should not have seen a mass exodus before the offering this morning. Not because people don't want to give, but because they do not want to commit murder when they give. The third example is a missed opportunity. Overlooked because of anger kills reconciliation. The third illustration involves a stroll down the road with someone with whom we have a strained relationship that we put up with. We walk along, we smile, we make small talk, all the while pretending nothing is wrong. And eventually the opportunity for reconciliation ends. In other words, we've done pretended ourselves all the way to the point that we forgot about what we were mad about or even what steps we can take to make it right. Reconciliation passes us by. And the consequences of our anger begin at that point. Because no longer are we pretending. We truly are angry. We truly are beyond reconciliation. And the situation continues to spiral out of control. Now, I warned you a few weeks ago that the Sermon on the Mount was not going to be easy. Because it's not. Jesus calls upon his believers to know that he wants more from us most of the time than what we're willing to give without encouragement. I've never killed anyone. That's what we think, right? And Jesus has to say something like this, and then I wonder whether I have broken the sixth commandment. And now we sit here this morning, some of us with blood on our hands. But as always in Christ, there is hope. And that's the joy of his message too. Because no matter what you have done to cause you to have that guilt or that shame or to be worried about whatever it is, he also has hope through Jesus to be reconciled. And so, his last words that he gave us in this section were, go and be reconciled. That's what the Father has told us. He told us to come and be reconciled, to ask for forgiveness. And if we do that, he will forgive us. And we will be reconciled, and we will be reset so that we can serve him as he would have us to do. And so we need to remember that the Father does know best. And he has given us our instructions in this section of the Sermon on the Mount. We're so thankful that he has given us this instruction because certainly most of the time we would have trouble. Being able to follow his instructions and even knowing what it is that he would have us to do. This morning, if you don't know Jesus, if there is an opportunity here for you to be able to follow him, to find the love that we're talking about, if you need reconciliation with Christ, this is the place. From where you're at, whatever, pray the prayer, ask God, believe God, that he would be able to take care of you and give you hope. As we have our invitation hymn, Come Ye Thankful People Come, a time of examination and prayer. So if you need prayer, please come forward and we'll pray with you.